Connecticut Yankee at King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain. It was in Warwick Castle that I came across the curious stranger whom I am going to talk about. We fell together, as modest people will, in the tail of the herd that was being shown through, and he at once began to say things which interested me. As he talked along, softly, pleasantly, flowingly, he seemed to drift away imperceptibly out of this world and time and into some remote era and old forgotten country, and so he gradually wove such a spell about me that I seemed to move among the specters and shadows and dust and mold of a gray antiquity, holding speech with a relic of it. Exactly as I would speak of my nearest personal friends or enemies, or my most familiar neighbors, he spoke of Sir Bedivere, Sir Bordeganee, Sir Lancelot of the Lake, Sir Galahad, and all the other great names of the Round Table, and how old, old, unspeakably old and faded and dry and musty and ancient he came to look as he went on. Presently he turned to me and said, just as one might speak of the weather or any other common matter, "You know about transmigrations of souls. Do you know about transpositions of epochs and bodies?" I said I had not heard of it. He was so little interested, just as when people speak of the weather, that he did not notice whether I made him any answer or not. There was half a moment of silence, immediately interrupted by the droning voice of the salaried cicerone.
"Ancient Hauberk, date of the 6th century, time of King Arthur and the Round Table. Said to have belonged to the knight Sir Sagramore le Desirous. Observe the round hole through the chain mail in the left breast. Can't be accounted for. Supposed to have been done with a bullet since invention of firearms, perhaps maliciously by Cromwell's soldiers."
My acquaintance smiled, not a modern smile, but one that must have gone out of general use many, many centuries ago, and muttered, apparently to himself, "Wit ye well, I saw it done." Then, after a pause, added, "I did it myself." By the time I had recovered from the electric surprise of this remark, he was gone. All that evening I sat by my fire at the Warwick Arms, steeped in a dream of the olden time, while the rain beat upon the windows and the wind roared about the eaves and corners. From time to time I dipped into old Sir Thomas Malory's enchanting book and fed at its rich feast of prodigies and adventures, breathed in the fragrance of its obsolete names, and dreamed again. Midnight being come at length, there was a knock at the door, and my stranger came in. I gave him a pipe and a chair and made him welcome. I also comforted him with a hot Scotch whiskey, gave him another one, and then still another, hoping always for his story. After a fourth persuader, he drifted into it himself in a quite simple and natural way.
"I am an American," he told me. "I was born and reared in Hartford in the state of Connecticut, anyway, just over the river in the country, so I am a Yankee of the Yankees and practical. Yes, and nearly barren of sentiment, I suppose, or poetry, in other words. My father was a blacksmith, my uncle was a horse doctor, and I was both along at first. Then I went over to the great arms factory and learned my real trade, learned all there was to it, learned to make everything, guns, revolvers, cannon, boilers, engines, all sorts of labor-saving machinery. Why, I could make anything a body wanted, anything in the world, it didn't make any difference what. And if there wasn't any quick, newfangled way to make a thing, I could invent one, and do it as easy as rolling off a log. I became head superintendent, had a couple of thousand men under me. Well, a man like that is a man that is full of fight. That goes without saying. With a couple of thousand rough men under one, one had plenty of that sort of amusement. I had, anyway. At last I met my match, and I got my dose. It was during a misunderstanding conducted with crowbars with a fellow we used to call Hercules. He laid me out with a crusher alongside the head that made everything crack and seemed to spring every joint in my skull and make it overlap its neighbor. Then the world went out in darkness, and I didn't feel anything more and didn't know anything at all, at least for a while. When I came to again, I was sitting under an oak tree on the grass with a whole beautiful and broad country landscape all to myself, nearly. Not entirely, for there was a fellow on a horse looking down at me, a fellow fresh out of a picture book. He was in old-time iron armor from head to heel, with a helmet on his head the shape of a nail keg with slits in it, and he had a shield and a sword, and a prodigious spear. And his horse had armor on, too, and a steel horn projecting from his forehead, and gorgeous red and green silk trappings that hung down all around him like a bedquilt, nearly to the ground.
"Fair sir, will ye just?"
said this fellow.
"Will I which?"
"Will ye try a passage of arms for land or lady, or for—"
"What are you giving me?" I said. "Get along back to your circus, or I'll report you." Now what does this man do but fall back a couple of hundred yards, and then come rushing at me as hard as he could tear, with his nail keg bent down nearly to his horse's neck, and his long spear pointed straight ahead. I saw he meant business, so I was up the tree when he arrived. He allowed that I was his property, the captive of his spear. I judged it best to humor him. We fixed up an agreement whereby I was to go with him, and he was not to hurt me. I came down, and we started away, I walking by the side of his horse. We marched along, through glades and over brooks, which I could not remember to have seen before, which puzzled me and made me wonder, and yet we did not come to any circus or sign of a circus. So I gave up the idea of a circus, and concluded he was from an asylum. But we never came to any asylum, so I was up a stump, as you may say. I asked him how far we were from Hartford. He said he had never heard of the place, which I took to be a lie, but I allowed it to go at that. At the end of an hour, we saw a faraway town sleeping in a valley by a winding river, and beyond it, on a hill, a vast gray fortress with towers and turrets, the first I had ever seen out of a picture. "Bridgeport," said I, pointing.
"Camelot,"
said he. It was then that my stranger, as he told his tale, had been showing signs of sleepiness. He caught himself nodding now, and smiled one of those pathetic, obsolete smiles of his, and said,
"I find I can't go on, but come with me. I've got it all written out, and you can read it if you like."
In his chamber, he said, "First, I kept a journal. Then, by and by, after years, I took the journal and turned it into a book. How long ago that was." He handed me his manuscript and pointed out the place where I should begin.
"Begin here. I've already told you what goes before."
He was steeped in drowsiness by this time. As I went out at his door, I heard him murmur sleepily,
"Give you good night, fair sir."
I sat down by my fire and examined my treasure. The first part of it, the great bulk of it, was parchment and yellow with age. I turned to the place indicated by my stranger and began to read as follows. "Camelot? Camelot?" said I to myself. "I don't seem to remember hearing of it before. Name of the asylum, likely." It was a soft, reposeful summer landscape, as lovely as a dream and as lonesome as Sunday. The air was full of the smell of flowers and the buzzing of insects and the twittering of birds, and there were no people, no wagons. There was no stir of life, nothing going on. As we approached the town, signs of life began to appear. At intervals, we passed a wretched cabin with a thatched roof, and about it small fields and garden patches in an indifferent state of cultivation. There were people, too, and rude sorts of folk. All of the people stared at me, ran into the huts and fetched out their families to gape at me. In the town, the streets were mere crooked alleys and unpaved. We followed one winding alley and then another, and climbing, always climbing, till at last we gained the breezy height where a huge castle stood. There was an exchange of bugle blasts, then a parley from the walls, where men-at-arms marched back and forth, flapping banners with the rude figure of a dragon displayed upon them. And then the great gates were flung open, the drawbridge was lowered, and the head of the cavalcade swept forward under the frowning arches, and we, following, soon found ourselves in a great paved court, with towers and turrets stretching up into the blue air on all four sides. And all about us the dismount was going on, and much greeting and ceremony and running to and fro, and a gay display of moving and intermingling colors, and an altogether pleasant stir and noise and confusion. The moment I got a chance, I slipped aside privately and touched an ancient, common-looking man on the shoulder and said in an insinuating, confidential way, "Friend, do me a kindness. Do you belong to the asylum, or are you just here on a visit or something like that?" He looked me over stupidly and said,
Marry, fair sir, meseem if...
That will do, I said. I reckon you are a patient. I moved away, cogitating, and at the same time keeping an eye out for any chance passenger in his right mind that might come along and give me some light. I judged I had found one presently. This was an airy, slim boy in shrimp-colored tights that made him look like a forked carrot. The rest of his gear was blue silk and dainty laces and ruffles, and he had long yellow curls and wore a plumed pink satin cap tilted complacently over his ear. By his look, he was good-natured. By his gait, he was satisfied with himself. He was pretty enough to frame. He arrived, looked me over with a smiling and impudent curiosity, said he had come for me, and informed me that he was a page. "Go along," I said. "You ain't more than a paragraph." It was pretty severe, but I was nettled. However, it never fazed him. He didn't appear to know he was hurt. He began to talk and laugh, in happy, thoughtless, boyish fashion, as we walked along, and made himself old friends with me at once. Asked me all sorts of questions about myself and about my clothes, but never waited for an answer. Always chattered straight ahead as if he didn't know he had asked a question and wasn't expecting any reply, until at last he happened to mention that he was born in the beginning of the year 513. It made the cold chills creep over me. I stopped and said a little faintly, "Maybe I didn't hear you just right. Say it again, and say it slow. What year was it?"
513.
513? Come, my boy, I am a stranger and friendless. Be honest and honorable with me. Are you in your right mind? He said he was. Are these other people in their right minds? He said they were. And this isn't an asylum? I mean, it isn't a place where they cure crazy people? He said it wasn't. Well then, I said, either I am a lunatic, or something just as awful has happened. Now tell me, honest and true, where am I?
In King Arthur's court.
I waited a minute to let that idea shudder its way home and then said, and according to your notions, what year is it now?
528, 19th of June.
I seemed to believe the boy. I didn't know why. Something in me seemed to believe him. My consciousness, as you may say. But my reason didn't. My reason straightway began to clamor. That was natural. I didn't know how to go about satisfying it, because I knew that the testimony of men wouldn't serve. My reason would say they were lunatics and throw out their evidence. But all of a sudden I stumbled on the very thing. Just by luck, I knew that the only total eclipse of the sun in the first half of the 6th century occurred on the 21st of June, A.D. 528, and began at 3 minutes after 12 noon. I also knew that no total eclipse of the sun was due in what to me was the present year, i.e. 1879. So, if I could keep my anxiety and curiosity from eating the heart out of me for 48 hours, I should then find out for certain whether this boy was telling me the truth or not.